This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Ihis Wuhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
It was a bit surprising that Gabon, unlike many African countries that have some general institutional trust in election institutions, was as low as they were. And in fact, I think what was surprising was that magnitude of how low that trust was.
That's Peter Pienaar, an author of a survey suggesting Gabon voter mistrust of their electoral system. Details coming up. Also in Zimbabwe, shops and businesses had opened as usual, despite calls from opposition groups for a strike. And a new census report indicates the African elephant population numbers are declining by about 8% per year. We have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, violent clashes have erupted in Gabon's capital after the Electoral Commission announced yesterday that incumbent President Ali Bongo had been re-elected. Soon after the outcome was announced, protesters attacked the National Assembly in Libreville, and later in the night, government forces stormed the headquarters of opposition leader Jean Ping. Emilia Yub has more on the story.
Government forces said they assaulted the headquarters of political opponent Jean Ping to arrest the people responsible for setting fire to the National Assembly building. Protesters took to the street Wednesday, soon after the National Electoral Commission said incumbent President Ali Bongo won Saturday's elections with 49.8% of the vote, defeating his main rival, Jean Ping, by a little more than 5,000 votes nationally. In Bongo's stronghold province, Oouge, the official result showed that 95% of the voters cast their ballot in favor of Bongo, and the voter turnout was 99%. The opposition says these numbers are not credible. Serge Maurice Mabiela, a former minister and current member of Ping's campaign, says that they demand the ballot to be recounted so that all the light is shed on what they consider a political holdup. Ali Bongo is the son of former President Omar Bongo, who ruled the country for over four decades until his death in 2009. Later that year, his son took over after winning a controversial election, which was also marred by post-election violence and accusations of fraud. 7 years later, the oil-dependent economy is hurting from the slump in oil prices and social discontent is growing. Paul Melly, Central Africa analyst at the London-based Chatham House, says the stakes are high.
In effect, the voters were being asked, are you happy to continue with the continuation of rule by a member of the Bongo family, or do you think that Gabon should make this step of breaking with the Bongo and having as president somebody who's not from that family?
Opposition leader Jean Ping, a former ally of Bongo's father and a former government minister, turned to the opposition in 2014 and says he wants to restore individual freedoms and democracy.
That's why the stakes were much higher in this election and why there's a lot more emotion and pressure behind it. And so there is a risk that the tension, instability, possible violence could continue for some time.
France, the European Union, and the United States have called on Gabon's government to release results from each polling station and said that anyone wishing to challenge the result must do so peacefully through Gabon's legal system. Emily Yap for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The turmoil in Gabon comes amid public distrust over the way elections in their country are carried out. That lack of confidence was measured as part of a study by Afrobarometer. It's an independent research network that polls Africans on democracy and governance. Its latest report surveyed public opinion in 36 countries on such questions as trust in their electoral systems and the freedom and fairness of the polls. Peter Pienaar is a lead author of the study. He's also a distinguished fellow at Michigan University in the Department of Political Science. Reporter William Eagle asked him if he was surprised that among the countries surveyed, Gabonese voters had the least trust in their electoral commissions.
It was a bit surprising that Gabon, unlike many African countries that have some general institutional trust in election institutions, was as low as they were. And in fact, the magnitude, I think what was surprising was that magnitude of how low that trust was, where you have an actual majority of Gabonese, 51%, saying that in late 2015, that CNAP, which is the election commission in Gabon, should not have any trust. They did not have any trust. And in addition, if you add in those that had a little trust, you see that there were 75%, three-fourths of Gabonese saying that they had not at all any trust in the election commission or just a little trust. And this is highly surprising in comparison to others. And it has to do with past experiences in elections in Gabon, most recently their legislative elections in 2011.
And what was it about those elections and the Electoral Commission that led to such great mistrust on the part of the public?
Well, in past elections, there have been major concerns about how elections have been held, you know, the freeness and fairness of elections. And for example, the Afrobarometer study that we're talking about, 37% of citizens saw the 2011 legislative elections as being completely free and fair. That suggests that a lot of people didn't view those elections as fair. And a lot of it had to do with opposition strength in the country that was challenging the current government and people feeling like that opposition was not necessarily getting a fair shake when it came to elections and seriously questioning election quality. Gabon actually ranks last in terms of the level of election quality, looking at that 2011 election, their last election, which we asked about.
What were the findings with regard to voter perceptions of the environment leading up to the polls?
Afrobarometer asked a number of questions about Gabonese and their experiences in the election cycle. You know, the perceptions of that election environment. How often are votes counted freely and fairly, which is an issue right now in terms of the count process. And we find, interestingly, that 71% said that votes are never or only sometimes counted fairly. So again, nearly three-fourths of Gabonese really questioning the vote count, which is right now at issue in the country. In addition, looking at fear and intimidation that may surround the polls, at least two-thirds, 64%, see that they think that violence is at least a little bit there or have experienced it, and 23% have expressed a lot of fear, you know, associated with elections. And these are fairly high numbers of anxiety when it comes to the election process and fear for personal safety and being able to vote freely. Another key piece is, you know, a majority of the citizens, 56%, said that the opposition candidates at least sometimes are prevented from running for office. And in fact, of those, 1 in 5, 22% said this happens often and always. And as we see in a number of elections, Uganda's elections in February and other elections in Africa, but particularly as we're talking about Gabon, the freedom for the opposition to really campaign and to mobilize is a really key factor in achieving an election victory or achieving the freedom of contestation. And we see very high levels of citizens being concerned about the level in which an opposition can really function freely in the country.
Gabon is a member of the Economic Commission of Central African States, or ECOS. Do other surrounding countries, neighbors, have the same problems? And is there any likelihood that a regional organization such as ECOS would step in or impose in the future electoral standards and observation teams so that this type of violence and mistrust does not happen?
Well, you bring up a very interesting point. Regional bodies in Africa have been involved increasingly in election affairs, such as the African Union with long-term observation missions and sub-regional bodies, that is the ECOWAS, ECOWAS's SADC, East African Community, and what we're talking about here is the Central African version, ECAS. And ECAS has been fairly silent over the years on election issues, and a lot of this grows out of the countries that are there and the priorities that they have set. Versus countries in ECOWAS, which have sort of begun to raise the bar in terms of election standards. And as ECAS has generally been silent on this issue, it will be very interesting to see whether they act or whether other regional bodies, the African Union, will have something to say. Particularly because Jean Ping, who is the actual leader of the opposition, is in fact the former chairman of the African Union. So he definitely has some contacts and connections to the regional body as well.
That was Peter Pienaar, a political scientist and fellow at Michigan State University and researcher of the Africa Barometer Polling Group. He was speaking to reporter William Eagle. Mass protests against Zimbabwe's government failed to materialize yesterday amid heavy police and military presence in Harare and other major cities. Shops and businesses had opened as usual, despite calls from opposition groups for a strike. Another protest had been planned for tomorrow, but it's too early to tell whether it will meet with any success. Last Friday, police used tear gas and water cannon to break up demonstrations against high unemployment and unpaid salaries due to a cash crisis. Nearly 70 people were arrested. President Robert Mugabe has blamed foreign governments for the demonstrations. The U.S. and other countries say they support the right to assembly for Zimbabweans who wish to protest. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. After incumbent President Ali Bongo's re-election was announced yesterday, violent clashes have erupted in Gabon's capital. And in Zimbabwe, shops and businesses have opened as usual, despite calls from opposition groups for a strike. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The latest monitoring report has been released on cluster munitions. It says while more nations are adhering to the treaty banning the weapons, they're still being used in some conflicts today. There were over 400 cluster munition casualties last year, nearly all of them civilians. Mary Wareham of Human Rights Watch is one of the editors of the Cluster Munition Monitor 2016 report. From Geneva, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa about the weapons and where they're being used.
Cluster munitions are weapons that are dropped from the air, from aircraft, and also launched from the ground, and rockets and artillery and mortar rounds. They contain multiple smaller explosive submunitions that are supposed to detonate on impact at the time of attack, but many, however, result in unexploded ordnance because they fail to explode. And that leaves very dangerous duds, which are in effect like landmines and have to be cleared and destroyed for years to come.
Are they being used in any ongoing conflicts?
Unfortunately, we're seeing almost daily reports of the use of cluster munitions at the moment in the conflict in Syria. These are airdropped cluster munitions that we believe are being used by the military operation conducted by Syrian government forces together with Russia since the end of 2015. It's not a new thing. The Syrian government has been using them since mid-2012. So you can just imagine the amount of unexploded ordnance that has been created. We've also documented attacks involving the use of cluster munitions in Yemen over the past year by this coalition of nations that Saudi Arabia is leading in its operation against the local Houthi forces there in Yemen. Also civilian casualties, also creating a big problem of unexploded ordnance to be cleared.
Now, I see that there are reports that Kenya allegedly used cluster munitions in Somalia in January of this year.
Right. This is of concern to us, but we treat it as just what you described it as a report, because we were not able to access the location where these cluster munitions were reported to have been dropped. It was a local media article that ran a story alleging that the Kenyan Air Force had dropped the cluster bombs across the border in Somalia. The United Nations did try to follow up into this incident, which we believe to have occurred in January of this year. It issued a report for the Security Council a few months ago, basically noting the use of cluster munitions and noting that the Kenyan government had denied the use in this instance. So the best thing for Kenya to do at the moment is to complete its ratification of the Convention on Cluster Munitions, and then it can declare if it's got any stocks and destroy them. And there is help available to destroy those stockpiles if it has them.
Now, the two countries you mentioned earlier, Syria and Yemen, have not signed on to the Cluster Munitions Treaty. Is that correct?
Correct. Neither Syria nor Yemen have signed, nor these actors who are involved in the conflicts in those countries. I should, however, note in our report we do have this confirmation from the Operation Inherent Resolve coalition that the U.S. is leading in Iraq and Syria against the Islamic State forces. They made a very clear comment that that coalition is not using cluster munitions in its air campaign in those countries.
What is the status of the Cluster Munitions Treaty?
We've got 100 countries that have signed and ratified the Convention on Cluster Munitions. Another 19 signatories still need to complete their ratification, and that's a parliamentary process. We believe that they eventually will get there. So that's the status of the convention at the moment. And we see very good progress being made in terms of implementation, particularly with respect to the destruction of stockpiled cluster munitions over the past year. Some major stockpilers, including Germany, Italy, and France, as well as Mozambique, have completed their stockpile destruction, and millions of these cluster munitions have been destroyed.
You had mentioned the United States. Where does it stand on the munitions treaty?
The United States did not participate in the negotiation of the 2008 Convention on Cluster Munitions. It hasn't attended any of the meetings, which are open to observer countries. It really has not commented publicly on the Convention on Cluster Munitions. But we did see this year the U.S. is sensitive to criticism over cluster munitions. It suspended sales and deliveries of cluster munitions to Saudi Arabia in May due to concern at the reporting by Human Rights Watch and others of the use of cluster munitions in Yemen and the resulting civilian casualties. So we see some sensitivity there, but also the United States does not hesitate to say that these are, you know, legitimate weapons. It regards them as militarily legitimate weapons. But the last U.S. cluster munition attack that we are aware of was in 2009 in Yemen. That was one attack which killed dozens of civilians. The last major use of cluster munitions by the United States was more than a decade ago during the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
That's Mary Wareham of Human Rights Watch. She's one of the editors of the Cluster Munition Monitor 2016 report from Geneva. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. A new census of the African elephant population reveals their numbers are declining by about 8% per year. The survey says there are about 357,000 savanna elephants left. The decline is primarily due to the illegal ivory trade driven by poaching across Africa's savannas. The survey says Angola, Mozambique, and Tanzania have experienced greater population declines than previously known. It also shows that elephants may face local extinction in parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Cameroon, and Zambia. On a positive note, the numbers of elephants in South Africa, Uganda, and parts of Malawi and Kenya were stable for partly increasing. The study involved an aerial survey of 18 countries and the work of 90 scientists. The survey was funded by Microsoft co-founder and philanthropist Paul Allen. Amid a public outcry over a series of highly publicized clashes between farmers and herdsmen in Nigeria, one Nigerian state enacted a law this week regulating the activity of nomadic cattle herders. As Chris Stein reports from Lagos, the new law is not without controversy.
Nomadic cattle herders and small-scale farmers are central figures of Nigeria's agrarian economy. They have long coexisted in peace, but a series of clashes have erupted between the two groups in the past several months. Farmers blame herdsmen for attacking villages and allowing their cattle to trespass on farmland and eat crops. Herdsmen say hostile villagers kill their cattle. The clashes have been taking place across Nigeria's south and middle belt and have left dozens dead. Peter Eodeli Feyoshe, governor of the southwestern Ekiti state, recently signed a bill into law that allows grazing only during the daytime and bans herdsmen from carrying weapons. Larry Olayinka is a spokesman for the governor.
It is a way of finding answers to the question of all this issue of herdsmen invading people's farmland, destroying farmlands at will, and killing almost everywhere in the country.
In a bid to keep herdsmen off roads and away from farmland, Olayinka says the law mandates that herdsmen graze only in certain reserves.
There will be designated area where you can have your ranch, probably pay some amount of money to the state government, have your ranch, and the ranch belongs to you where you can keep your cattle.
The law does not put to rest the debate over nomadic cattle grazing in Nigeria. Zayanu Muhammad is the secretary of the Ekiti State Branch of the Miyeti Ala Cattle Breeders Association of Nigeria, which was consulted by the state government during the writing of the bill. He objected to the law's ban on carrying weapons. He says many herdsmen carry machetes for self-defense.
We use that cutlass and guide ourselves.
Saleh Bayari, a former national chairman of the association, says the bill's new regulations would limit the already scarce land where herdsmen can graze, increasing competition. He says the federal government should set up nationwide reserves for herdsmen to graze their cattle.
Without the cattle ranches and without the grazing reserves, then there are state governors like Ekiti who are already banning grazing. It simply means that the herdsman will have to know how to survive.
Bayari says he expects the new law to face a court challenge. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and then tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, I tell you, this one, I
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.